Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I am Priyam Sinha, the host of today's interview with Dr. Bishnu Priya Ghosh. First of all, heartiest congratulations to you, Dr. Ghosh, for your recently published book, The Virus Touch, and thank you very much for accepting our invitation. Professor Ghosh teaches at the Department of English and Global Studies at UC Santa Barbara. She studies global media cultures, environmental media, and critical health studies. Her early research includes two monographs, When Born Across Literary Cosmopolitics in the Contemporary Indian Novel and Global Icons, Apertures to the Popular, while the co-edited volume exemplifies her current research, The Rutledge Companion to Media and Risk, and a new monograph, The Virus Touch, Theorizing Epidemic Media. Today, we will discuss her insightful journey of researching and writing The Virus Touch. In The Virus Touch, Bishnu Priya Ghosh argues that media are central to understanding emergent relations between viruses, humans, and non-human life. Writing in the shadow of the HIV/AIDS and COVID-19 global pandemics, Professor Ghosh theorizes epidemic media to show how epidemics are mediated in images, numbers, and movements through the processes of reading test results and tracking infection and mortality rate. Welcome, Professor Ghosh, and thank you very much
for accepting our invitation. Thank you for the invitation to join you on New Books Network.
Before we immerse into more elaborate discussion about your book, you could tell us about what informed your decision to research global mediascapes and more specifically environmental media.
Yes, thanks for the question. It's one that I get asked quite often, that how would somebody who was trained in global literary studies come to write such a book? And the answer is, of course, complex. It's the coming together of two interests, you could say. Even my first book, which was a very literary book, was not really only about literary fiction. It was already looking at how, you know, literary texts like Arundhati Roy's God of Small Things had become a global product. And my second book, Global Icons, Apertures to the Popular, was kind of completed in the early 21st century. And by then, I was really interested in visual culture and how people like Arundhati Roy and Mother Teresa and Pulan Devi were being consumed as icons. So I moved quite centrally to thinking about global media. Then two things happened. One is 9/11, in which you had the global war on terror break out, and of course you had people from various parts of the world regarded, particularly Muslims, being regarded as politically risky subjects. And on the other, by then, I had considerable experience, a generational loss of friends and communities from HIV/AIDS. I was of a generation, the pre-retroviral generation, that is before 1995, when a lot of people had died of HIV/AIDS. And then post-1995 in the historical West or the global North, whatever you'd like to call it, there was a sense that there's a medical triumph, and certainly it was that, but the AIDS crisis was over. But my work is always in South Asia, and I was hearing a very different story from activist organizations there. It was the story of precarity, of losses, of difficult access to meds. And this came out of a series of interviews I had done in Manipur. And so I began to think of these two things together, and we had launched a project at the time. This is about 2008. Nine called Media and Risk. And I was given the essay, which was supposed to be on biologically risky subjects. And then, of course, what started as an essay in 2010 ended up being a whole book. And how I got from thinking about the global pandemic and its circulation in media scapes to environmental media is another story, and I hope we'll get to talk about that a little bit further in this interview.
Thank you so much. That actually set the tone and background for all of your work. So that brings me to the next question. Why did you journey into theorizing epidemic media while breaking down that format within the complexity of human and non-human interactions?
Yes, so as the word epidemic tells you, from it's a condition against the demos. So even the word is quite anthropocentric, right? It's about infection or chronic infection or acute infection in human communities, and that's often the way we approach epidemics as events, right? We invent medical solutions and vaccines, and thank God for them. Okay, I'm not an anti-vaxxer, and I'm absolutely grateful to medicine and science for finding those solutions. But as I came to think about the most, you could say, paradigmatic form of epidemics, acute infectious epidemics, they're really viral emergences. And we haven't really got our, let's say, a control of them in the way we have, bacterial ones, because of course we still don't have something like penicillin that can kill viruses. There's nothing equivalent, right? So I began to think about how viral experiences, emergences, sorry, are the extreme instance of the acute infectious disease epidemic. And that led me to the early 1980s, when you have this huge sudden outburst of HIV, Hanta, Ebola, Marburg, right? Deadly viruses that sort of really shocked everybody. Because by 1978, 1980, the WHO had announced the end of smallpox, right? One of the longest, bitterest fights between humans and viruses had been won. And bam, suddenly you had all these viruses come into the world. And at that time, there was a sense, with an emerging infectious disease conference in Washington, D.C., that we were really looking at epidemics as environmental disasters. And instead of looking at community transmission, that is, transmission within a host population, what we should be really looking at is the first step, which is often cross-species transmission, right? So viruses jumping between species, zoonotic transmissions. And right now, some EID models or emerging infectious disease models tells us that about 60.3 of viral emergences are cross-species transmissions, and 71.3% of them are human and wildlife contact, right? So this is the issue, that we're really looking at the relationship between a microbe and its animal host, and then the skipping from one animal host to another, which sent me looking at not just human or host-to-host transmission, but actually a much larger, you could say, landscape of viral emergence. And one more thing I'd say is, of course, The virus itself was very intriguing to me because it's a curious border object. It's a form of non-life that suddenly comes alive when it sees a host. That is to say, it has two characteristics of life, right? It has irritability and it reproduces, but it can't metabolize, right? So it actually needs a host resources to survive. Right. So, this idea of this parasitic thing that is partly geological and biological, and then you have different species, made this very much also about thinking about environmental media and not just, sort of remain within, say, the medical humanities or critical health studies.
Thank you so much. That was a very interesting approach. And that also brings me to my next question. I was also left wondering about the book's title and significance in a rather optimistic light about epidemic media. In recent times, most references to epidemics have a tendency to foreground the loss, disruption, fatality, precarity. And here there seemed to be a humbling theorization of a virus touch. Could you tell us more about what led you to pursue such a principle in naming and even framing your anthropological investigation?
Yes, thanks for the question. It's a title I decided on very early, in the work. And when I was naming it, it was partly intuitive. And I'll say why. I think one of the things that has been said, so HIV now can be a chronic condition, although only 67% of the world's HIV affected can access the antiretrovirals, right? But let's say it's ma managed HIV is the sort of the global horizon for HIV/AIDS, right? And that is often thought of squarely as something that the huge global biomedical infrastructure, with the WHO, then medical discoveries, all that has actually achieved. But what I have found, and because I've been with this epidemic for like 4 decades now with friends and communities, I know that in order for people to actually stay on their medications, you had all kinds of people involved, right? From health counselors to doctors to nurses to friends and lovers and caregivers and all other kinds of people. So I've always thought of HIV/AIDS as a massive distributed experiment. And so the virus touch was actually a recognition of that, living close, living on, living with. And all the kinds of labor and care that it takes, right, really is implied by touch because one of the stigmas, early stigmas, ignorant stigmas about HIV/AIDS was it could be just transmitted, say, from a toilet seat or from kissing. And so I was really going against that, and sort of pointing to the care behind HIV communities. The second thing is, I think, what is at the center of the book, which is actually the making of scientific, what I call epistemic objects, right? Within the sciences, how you make an epistemic object like a viral image. And one of the things that you do is to place this object, say a viral particle, within cellular fluids, right? So you create both an object and an environment, and you make this a careful demarcation of the boundary. Yeah, within which you and scale within which you have to think about this object, right? You think of the blood test, right? X number of viral particles in Y ml of blood, right? We've all had a PCR test with the COVID experience, right? So you have a valuable object and you have the blood or saliva as the environment. Now, this idea of, containing, okay, and making legible or comprehensible a particular a representation of infection, right? So X ml of viral particles and Y ml of blood is a representation of your state of infection. Right. And what is very interesting in the experience of epidemics is even though you have the blood test, even though you have the safety of numbers, even though you have this blood picture at one point, right, you always have a sense, an uncanny sense of infection being everywhere and all at once, right? You apprehend, right? Even though it may not be legible, you think of infection everywhere. And we began to see the air around us, the air between us with COVID, right? This is an experiential sense of the epidemic, right? And the virus touch actually refers to this experiential sense. So that's why I wanted to get at what the humanities does best, which is to talk about human experience and how we make meaning of human experiences. And so that's why it's called the virus touch. I know that's another long answer, but it gets at why touch.
Definitely, definitely. So that also sets the tone for the next question that I had in mind. So I wanted to highlight how and why you suggest the viral entry also as a territorial infraction. Usually, such scholarship has been dominated by studies on public health and biological sciences, which is something that you also mentioned. But what shaped your anthropological focus? And how can that be differentiated from those ways of breaking down the complexities of studying the virus and its touch?
Yeah, I think this leads very well from the last question you asked me, actually. Let me say that while the book has an anthropological focus in the sense that it is very interested in sort of the community interface, right? How public perceptions, ordinary life, everyday perceptions, non-expert understandings, and therefore collects stories. Around the world about that. I am not a trained ethnographer, right? My background is in literary, cultural, and media studies. So basically, I would say that the book is part ethnographic rather than fully anthropological or ethnographic. I did many interviews over time in laboratories, among activist communities, in clinics, and so on and so forth. But it's not, in the way that if you read Kaushik Sundarrajan's Biocapital, or if you read, Bruna Latour and Steve Woolgar's laboratory book on laboratory work. Those are, year-long ethnographies. So mine is not of that nature, right? So let me say that. But then the question, this is related to what your question about why are you interested in this particular idea of, the viral entry coming in. And that has to do with how people really perceive their states of acute infection, right? So whether it is within what seems like objective science or very subjective perceptions, one of the things that you always try to do with infection is to scale and measure it. You, as I said, a demarcated boundary within which you stabilize an object in order to study it and therefore find a solution, right? This, I find, is almost a kind of a security aesthetic, right? You try to limit the milieu that you study, right? And in fact, that limitation, right, is a kind of a failed project because, viruses will always keep coming, right? If you think of that barrier between breath and air, how breath becomes air and air becomes breath. Right? It's extremely permeable. And although we have tried so hard with masks, with social distancing, with so much to securitize ourselves, right? We have been only partly able to do that. Yeah. So I was very, very interested in how the perception of infection, whether it is in laboratory work or from a person who is actually experiencing infection, is always about this kind of breached boundaries, right? About contamination, about contagion, about something from the outside that comes in, something that you keep at bay. So I always think about epidemics or the perception of epidemics as something around the question of security. That's why this territorial infraction has been so important to me.
Definitely. So the first few pages of the book itself caught my attention, especially due to the integration of visual aids, and a lot more at the start, actually. While there has been an increased focus on now integrating visual data like photographs, sketches, comics, and graphs to make scholarship publicly accessible and more illustrative, while not making it text heavy, I'm sure our listeners would like to know more about the significance that it plays in explaining your work, and why did you have a lot of it actually set right in the beginning of your book?
Yeah, so I'll answer that in a couple of ways. One is, I think the visual field is actually very, very important to the study of microbial life, right? If you can think of Pasteur, Louis Pasteur studying bacteria, you know, in the 19th century, that's the beginning of germ theory, the mid 19th century. But the virus is actually a little more difficult. It is, you know, first really observed and named in the 1890s, as, you know, the virus means Latin for poison, but it's not actually identified as a particular object. And that's because it is so small that it's imperceptible to the naked eye for sure, right? So it's not until 1938 that you actually see the virus under the very powerful lens of an electron microscope. And so that the first history of the virus is an optical one, right? You see this microscopic image. Now, what's important there is that that has much to do with how then we began to develop a large study of viruses. So it was optical for a while. And then, of course, you have the cracking of the code in the mid-20th century, and then it becomes a strip of information, right? It becomes an informatic code. Now, there is this shift then. You're asking me about visuals. What is interesting is then, of course, the virus becomes studied in as number, right? How much virus is there in your blood? What is the viral code, right, that tells you it's this virus and not that, right? And all these kinds of things begin to enter the equation. And if you even think about our contemporary, our, you know, last pandemic, how often we've sat at home and watched, you know, the curve, the infection curve, rates of infection going up and up and up. Basically, you have the logic of numbers telling you about infection, but it is always the visual. The numbers are always visually coded in order for us to understand it. Whether it is the live world map, whether it is the graph, whether it is the curve, right? These are all drawings, they're all visual aids to making numbers comprehensible. So there is that long history of why we've always needed, besides the actual image, you know, the spiky image of the virus, besides the actual image, you have all kinds of visual forms making infection legible, right? And then the second part is, you could say, much more of what I saw in the labs that visualize the virus. That is, again, you have multiple streams of data coming in. You have genetic data, you have chemical data, you have morphological data. And they're all scientists crowdsource all of these data, and they try to form a hypothesis about what's going to happen to the virus next. And that hypothesis is often visualized, and this is scientific visualization. And the images actually capture a particular moment, a snapshot of a whole, right, at a particular moment. So I guess my answer to your question is twofold. One is that the visual is extremely important, has been extremely important through the 20th century to make the virus as number comprehensible to the public. And secondly, visualization, despite the datafication of the virus, visualization continues to be a very important tool to understand sort of the trajectory of the virus.
That actually inspires, and your work in that way also inspires a lot of us as early career research scholars to integrate visual aids in terms of just the kind of anthropological focus and ethnographic work that a lot of us do. So, another interesting aspect was how you mentioned about the relative dynamism in popular imaginaries, public preoccupation, and scientific technological intervention that even informs what is the epidemic media in need of immediate attention. Could you tell us more about such transient and inconsistent understandings of epidemic media, and what does it say about the assemblages and entanglements of humans and non-humans?
Wow, that's a tough question in many ways because I can go about it in, I mean, that's really a lot of the book. So thank you for reading it so carefully. I'll say, let me approach it in one way. One of the things that I found is that there are these understandings of being infected that are often differently valued. So one of, I think, a very inspiring book for me was Anne-Marie Moll's Body Multiple. And she's studying the history of a particular disease. Again, it's an ethnography in a hospital. And she talks about, what is exactly an illness, right? So you have a pathologist who's dissecting a particular a tissue, and he sees the state of an artery. Yeah. And he says that, from the medical perspective, this is the illness. Whereas for the patient, it's really the pain that you feel in your leg when you're climbing the stairs, right? So Anne-Marie Moll's point is what we think of as a particular illness, right? And this is the long history of many, many illnesses, including AIDS, including syphilis, including, tuberculosis, is that there are different perceptions, right? You might tell your doctor your symptoms, but the doctor will also consult with the pathologist to look at what your tissue tells him or her, right? So this idea of multiple accounts of a single thing. Anne-Marie Moll calls it the body multiple. And the point is, what we think about the body is something that emerges, right, from these, what you're calling these transient and inconsistent understandings, right? So I was very interested in HIV infection as something emerging at the cusp of things like statistics or personal narrations or scientific studies, right? You have a particular condition emerge as such. And if you think this way and you don't value one over the other, then you get actually a very different global history of AIDS. Right? It doesn't have a beginning and an end, but it is different all over the world in different sites. AIDS and HIV emerge differently.
Thank you so much for setting the tone for the next question I had in mind. So, although your book is not chronological in the most naive sense of its understanding, I seem to understand that there is still an inclination to draw upon an epidemic media chronology in a rather storytelling format. That made me curious to know more about how that journey took place. And I'm sure our listeners would like to understand what distinguishes your understanding and description of pandemic as a moment, while suggesting that such moments also re-enter the society or resurface in public memory in varied ways.
Yes, thanks for that question. Again, a really rich and complex question, I think. I'll say two things about stories or histories in the book. It is true that I've written a piece actually in the Journal of the History of the Present called Emergence and History, and it's a story about smallpox, right? And it's actually arguing for pandemics or epidemics as we see them, as these sudden unforeseen emergences, right? So the idea of the emergence, something emerging suddenly that you can't really anticipate, right? Really is a way of thinking about a non-linear form of history. And that was really one of the motivations for the book, that you actually see the viral image, viral mutations happening at one scale. Then you have, your body's infection proceeding at another scale. And then you have these cross-species interactions happening at another scale, right? These are very different histories. The book very deliberately moves across different scales because it wants to tell you different kinds of stories about the same infection, about the same illness. So this is a non-linear approach to the question of viral emergence. And so one of the things that I do in the book is not only sort of break it up that way, I mean, the structure of the book is that way, but it's a difficult thing to grasp. And let me say it by way of one story. Now, one of the well-documented things is, of course, the HIV origin story. And what it tells us is that, the looking for viral origins is really the wrong question to ask. Whether you're looking for the green monkey or you're looking for the patient zero, it's always the wrong question. What we have found with HIV, that of course it was, it came really from a co-infection of monkeys in a part of DRC Congo, right? And the HIV 1M group was very close to the Kinshasa highway. And that's where it skipped into human populations. This is sort of the broad picture, right? But what is more interesting about the story is why, you will always ask, why did the virus skip? And what usually you think, oh, well, the virus evolved, and then it becomes pathogenic. Well, actually, what happens is you have this co-infection between two kinds of monkeys. And one of the kinds of monkeys is the chimpanzee, and we are only 1% different from chimpanzees, right? So if you think of the virus and its logic, you like one host. If you see a host that's pretty similar, you think that's also a viable environment. So you can see how it would skip very easily between primates and humans. Well, you had all these primates live in these very heavily dense tropical forests. But what happens with deforestation is that the forests, the habitats get smaller and smaller and smaller. And these populations, some of whom had not been in contact with each other, are now pressed for the same food sources, for nesting, for water, right? They begin to compete. And there's co-infection among them. And the actual virulent strain emerges from, it's a mutation that comes from co-infection, right? I tell you this story. And then, of course, there's a building of the highway. And then there is human wildlife contact and the virus skips into human populations. This story is not one of, oh, that's where HIV began. It's a hypothesis. But what it tells us is that there are multiple things happening. There's a highway being built. There are forests being cut down. There are monkeys searching for food and water and new habitats. There's a virus that's evolving, right? Here you have numerous timelines coming together at different tempos and different speeds that gives rise to HIV-1 M group, right? So that's why I'm very interested in this non-linear history. The only way to tell you, make sense of a non-linear history is to make it into a story. And what I've told you now is just one story like that. So storytelling throughout the book is, you could say it's a tool that I give readers as a kind of a map or a guide to these very complicated nonlinear histories that is the real story of HIV/AIDS.
Thank you so much for that very insightful comment, because it also sets the tone for the next question that I had in mind. I was also very fascinated in noting down the many ways in which the epidemic media unfolds in your work. Could you tell us a bit more about how an epidemic informs or influences the relational sense of life? Also, what are the social, political, and economic implications of these viruses, which makes your anthropological study and investigation of these relationalities and non-linearities in body cultures and digital media?
Yeah, I mean, I think the when you're in a state of infection, right, you're immediately aware that something came from somewhere and it lives within you, right? So there is always a very ordinary sense of a relational sense of life. But this has been, of course, scientifically sort of established, right? By the 2010, you have the mapping of the human microbiome, in which we realize that you have microbial matter outweigh human cells 10 to 1, right? So if you actually took all the human matter away from your body, you'd have a kind of a ghostly shimmer of microbial matter. So we are always multi-species. We live relationally always with microbes within us. And you hear heard a lot about the gut microbiome and so on and so forth. So the idea that we are relational species-wise is already very much there. Then you have that set me moving towards, as I said, the virus, which is a parasitic form. Right? And it's a parasitic form which can't live by itself. So the virus actually moves, lives, reproduces within host media. So this idea is also the virus gives us a very deeply relational sense of life. And I think we can learn from it because, after all, we are also cannot live without the planet, right? Without, and of course, we live sometimes like parasites on the planet, right? Using up all the resources, right? So, in some ways, that relational sense of life was the something to learn from the virus in a way. And also there it's both a biological thing. It can lie dormant in the Earth's crust for many millennia, right? So it's also a geological thing, right? So I thought thinking through the virus was a very interesting way of getting to this deeply relational sense of life, which could be thought of in planetary ways, but also global ways, right? The way in which we're totally interdependent on one another. So that was one. And I was very interested in all kinds of forms by which we understand this. One form, which I think I've already talked about a little bit, if you think of watching that curve of infection, that we watched during COVID, it's going up and it's going down. And one day you see that, oh, it seems to be curving down again. Let's go out, and a whole bunch of people go and see a concert, right? So you make a kind of a social decision, yeah, based on an individual perception. And that decision actually will change the curve again, right? When people started to go out again, the curve changed, right? So if you watch any kind of epidemic media, you have this kind of feedback effect, right? Between sort of the social and the biological. Right, the infection rates, the virus's rate of infection is highly dependent on social behavior, and social behavior is dependent on the rate of infection. So what I would say is this relational idea is also about the relationship between our different actions, whether they are biological or they're ecological or social. Right? There's a relationship, a relation between all these domains of life that we inhabit. I hope that part makes sense. That's the more complex part, way of thinking about relationality.
Definitely, definitely. And it also sets the tone of understanding these different ways of knowing body cultures and digital media and epidemics. So, to undertake such a rigorous ethnographic work, especially during COVID-19, would have also been a challenge, more so since there were a lot more safety protocols during such precarious times. How did you overcome those adversities? And if you could tell us more about what led you to integrate such a comparative dimension with HIV/AIDS?
You know, it's so interesting, Priyam, that you should ask me that. The research was actually done before the COVID pandemic. So I had been writing this book since about, 2009, 10 is when I started to research it, and sort of did the conceptual work was done 2000 by 2013, 14, and I had begun the actual ethnographic research then. It had all sort of ground to a stop by, 2019. I was very involved in a lot of administrative work at my university, and sort of the book was languishing a bit, frankly, because I wasn't getting the time to actually finish it. And then COVID happened. And this is also for, I think, early career scholars. It's very interesting that how sudden changes can make what you were studying suddenly historical, right? So everything that I'd been working with and thinking about and thinking with HIV/AIDS was historical in a minute, right? When the first lockdown happened. And then I have to credit my publisher at Duke, Courtney Berger, with asking me, well, are you going to finish that book you were writing on epidemics and epidemic media? And I talked to her. She was always very inspiring. And she said, yeah, well, think about what you were writing and how salient it would be to think about this pandemic, even new as it is. So in 2020, 2021, I actually went back substantially to the book and finished it and rethought it. And you'll notice that all of the media, whether it is the image or whether it is the blood test or whether it's the story of primate human interactions, they're all from the HIV archives, right? But really, the idea is what can this 4-decade-long global pandemic with huge amounts of research, right? What has it offered us to think about pandemics in the future? So I was really writing about one pandemic in the middle of another, right? And so that's why you have this kind of comparative dimension, as you name it, come in, right? But that was not actually intended at all. And then I suddenly found myself in this scenario where I was also writing about COVID. And since then, of course, I've been asked to write many things about COVID. But really, the book I would say is HIV/AIDS as a History Lesson.
Thank you so much for actually referring to HIV/AIDS as a history lesson and also providing a very refreshing approach to COVID-19. It also says how academia can provide you with opportunities of accidental encounters, and research can definitely take a very different turn. So thank you so much for sparing your valuable time and insights. Before we leave, I'm certain our listeners would like to know more about your ongoing or upcoming book projects, chapters, articles that we can look forward to.
Oh my, that is a large question, Priyam, because as you can imagine, because I was writing this, and many people, of course, knew I was writing the book, I get asked a lot to write about epidemics. One of the projects that I'll tell you about that I think would be interesting to your listeners is something that I co-edited with Michael Berry. And it is on published on, Positions, the journal Positions has an online platform, positionspolitics.org. And we did co-edited this sort of online, let's say, ongoing series called First Looks. And it was about sort of the first understandings of COVID-19 when it happened in Asian contexts, right? So it's different parts of Asia, Southeast Asia, and South Asia. And I wrote a piece for that, and it was actually inspired by diaries or notes written by nurses and healthcare workers. And this, I think, for me, it was my tribute to them because the people on the front lines, before we had the vaccine, before we had the drugs, and this is true of all epidemics, the people who keep us alive are really the healthcare workers, right? And this happened all over the world. They work working multiple hours. They were drained. They had very little resources. And in the HIV/AIDS epidemic, there's a great actually archive called from the nurses called In Their Own Words. You know, in 1982, when they were seeing patients come in with a syndrome that no one quite understood, they took notes. Right? And those notes were the basis of later analysis. So my essay really is devoted to frontline workers. So that I think is an interesting collection. Many people writing about what it means to have a first look at a particular pandemic. The second set of essays I talk about is I've been asked a lot to write about the Indian case of experience of COVID-19. I've written about the lockdown and the migrant march when 1 million migrants had to walk home to their villages because the government had made no provision for them. And then again, the second wave in which, of course, there was a short supply of medical oxygen. And those essays are kind of a little bit different. They're quite critical of what I see to be sort of the dispensable poor populations who always bear the worst brunt of pandemics. And so there, I think there's a couple of essays in that fold that are about to come out. One is that thinks together with war, famine, and disease together as actually techniques for culling populations. That is, in animal studies, you cull animals, you cull the weakest in a herd, right? You actually kill them off. Right. I think epidemics again and again and again are brutal phenomena. The most vulnerable and the weakest are sometimes just let die. And we've seen this in wars, we've seen this in famines, and we've seen this in disease. And I bring up that set of essays because I can't help think while we're witnessing an ongoing genocide in Gaza, that's what's happening there. It's a population culling, and of course, it's going on in the name of famine. So that's another set of essays I think that are really relevant. And finally, I'll say I'm coming my these chapters. I'm really working now on a set of essays that will become a book called Epidemic Intensities. And I'm thinking about the word intensity as a way of getting to this very differential experiences all over the world of a same globally synchronic event like a global pandemic. So you think COVID is, a global pandemic? Sure, it is. But it's extremely differently experienced everywhere. And the Indian case has only made that more and more visible to me. So, new book, Epidemic Intensities. I'm totally at the beginning of, writing perhaps the first chapter, but that's what's in the future. But thank you for asking.
Thank you so much. And there is so much to really look forward to in the upcoming years of a lot of your scholarly work being out and possibly us having another interview on your next book. Thank you once again for accepting our request and for this very insightful conversation about your book.
Thank you, Priyam.